Welcome to Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Lakshdatta. This episode is the edited version of a live session from the Jaipur Literature Festival 2021. The curious incident of the author who couldn't be categorized, Mark Haddon in conversation with Sandeep Roy.
Mark Haddon, welcome virtually to the Jaipur Literature Festival.
It's very good to be virtually here. Thank you.
Well, I was rereading the Curious Incident, and I couldn't help but think about at the end, Christopher had talks about this favorite dream that he has, where almost everyone catches a virus and dies. No, that's a computer virus, but you can get it from watching an infected person on television. So I must begin by asking you, what has the year of the virus been like for you?
I think, like most writers, I'd have to say that we live in a semi-locked down state anyway. So in that sense, it's not been bad. And of course, I suppose all around the world, there's a huge social gulf, isn't there? If you have a nice house, you have a garden, and you get on well with your family, it's relatively easy. What's really hard is when you don't get on well with your family and you're on the 14th floor and you don't have a garden, and then it's really hard work. So I'm aware of having been hugely lucky.
But from what I understand, a year before, you had a heart bypass. So you already had a sort of year in lockdown even before the rest of the world went into lockdown, didn't you?
It was a very peculiar kind of lockdown. I think anyone who's had major surgery will recognize this. Physically, I got better quite quickly, but my blood had been going through a machine for 4.5 hours. And I think for the next year, I suffered from what is called pump head. It's a kind of fog which prevented me thinking clearly for a very, very long time. So by the end of that year, I was happily running 15 miles, but unable to think well enough to write.
That must have been extraordinarily scary. Could you paint?
A little. Funny enough, the whole experience was not terribly scary. I think if you have a heart attack and then you realize your body has betrayed you, it's one thing, but I knew that there was something wrong, and together with my doctor, we worked out what was wrong, and I went into hospital, and it was fixed. I feel like I won that battle with the Grim Reaper, hands down.
Yeah, people will read about like this vegetarian person who runs for miles every day, and you know he's getting a triple heart bypass right now. People are going to be scared, even if you feel like you weren't that scared.
I think there's a lesson there. Our governments try to tell us that our health is entirely in our own hands. We just have to behave properly, and we will live to a ripe old age. I think we all learn as we get older and our families get older that there is much more chance involved than we assume. And you, at some point, you just have to accept that life happens to you and you don't have huge amounts of control over it.
Now, is it true, Mark, that I've heard that you yourself don't really like to travel that much?
I have a profound fear of flying and a great love of home. You can do many things, obviously, when you travel. I love the landscapes. I love the people. I dislike the means of getting there. And particularly when it comes to literary festivals, there's a peculiar sadness to nights spent in a hotel on your own far away from home. I know for some people it's a great relief, but for me, it's a very melancholy experience.
And then there we were in a world which itself, where travel had shut down. So the rest of the world joined you in this, whether they may not have had the same love for home that you did.
But the strange upside, and I've only learned this very recently, is Zoom, which we're on now, has opened up new avenues, both for other people and for me. I was recently being the guest reader for a friend who was running creative writing classes in Sydney. It took me 30 seconds to get there, and I came home afterwards, and that was it. The Arvon Foundation, for whom I teach often in England, they run creative writing classes. They've had to go online, so that takes away some of the experience. On the other hand, some of the people attending the courses now are either seriously ill or they have mobility issues. I know someone on a recent course was in a psychiatric hospital, but able to take part in the course. And I thought that was rather fantastic. Yeah. And I know that I've been in touch with other authors with whom I'd never been in contact before. Beforehand, you would have had to take the risk of saying, can we go out for lunch together to see if we like one another? That's quite a big risk in terms of time and emotion. Now you can say, do you fancy talking for an hour on Zoom? And it works or it doesn't work. And I've made friendships that way, in a way that I never expected at the beginning of the pandemic.
And if it doesn't work with Zoom, you can always say, oh my God, I'm having connectivity issues, and sign off.
And it's only ever an hour of your time, and it's easy.
But speaking of travel and journeys, Porpoise, your latest book, is a story of great journeys, both across physical journeys across oceans and journeys across time, because part of it is set in contemporary times, part in the times of Pericles, the great hero, and the great adventurer. I don't know if he's a hero at the end of the book, but, and in the time of Shakespeare and stuff. So this in a way is a huge departure from the small town focus of some of your earlier books, where even getting to London, in the case of the Curious Incident, was a huge adventure for people. So was this a big leap of faith for you?
There was an intermediate stage, which is my collection of short stories called The
Pier. Where you even go to Mars, so yes.
Yes, true. Yes. And my wonderful agent, Claire Alexander, said when she read that collection of short stories that, Mark, you used to write novels in which almost nothing happened. Now you seem to have written a collection of short stories in which almost everything happens. And that, for me, was in part a reaction to, I would guess, the most common idiom of short story, particularly in the UK and America, in the last 50 years, I guess, quite Carver-esque, quite minimal, quite modest and melancholic. I was, to be honest, quite tired with that. I wanted to do big short stories, a little more like 19th century short stories, in which there was no sense of limitation whatsoever. Having done that, I wanted to go bigger. I was also very, very tired of reading novels about people like me. There have been too many people like me in books. Let's use that space for something different. So something else occurred to me only as I was doing it, that the novel is a vehicle which can go to so many places. It's extremely powerful. It has many, many levers and dials. So why not take it to those places? Why not stretch it to its limit? And I think the novel was in part a celebration of some of the things you can do with the novel.
That reminds me, actually, you said something about, like, until now, what was it that you, it's like you had the Millennium Falcon at your disposal and you were just going to Sainsbury's, supermarket.
That's right, yes. I mean, the novel is the Millennium Falcon. The novel is a spaceship. It can travel any distance through time, through cultures, through countries, through planets. And I read some novels when I think, you know, there are some wonderful, finely honed, deeply satisfying, minimalistic novels. But there are also many novels in which I think you have wasted opportunities here. I didn't want to waste opportunities.
You said you were tired of reading novels about people like you, but do you think there's an ever increasing danger where people say, you only get to write novels about people like you. How do you, how dare you co-opt my story?
It's interesting. When you talk to young people, I've done some events with young people, this question comes up a lot. I mean, it's a really live issue for lots of people. And in the last event I did, I think this image came to me, which I've used ever since. I was talking to a group of young doctors, and I was asked this question by a young trans woman who wanted to know whether I would rewrite Curious Incident differently this time around. I said, I think what you're really asking me is whether I'm one of those writers who, as you said, thinks there's a secret set of rules forbidding them from writing certain things. The way it seems to me is this: there's a spectrum. At one end of that spectrum, there are trans men and women and non-binary people and people of color. I would never write a first person narrative in their voice. That would seem a kind of theft of stories which belong to them. And at the other end of the spectrum, for me, for example, there are women's voices. I often write from the point of view of women, and I think that every male novelist should be forced to write from the point of view of a woman every now and then as a kind of boot camp to make sure they've got sufficient empathy muscles. And in between those two ends of the spectrum are many other kind of points of view. There might be someone with autism, someone with schizophrenia, someone with depression, someone who's gay, for example, you know. And we can argue about where put it this way, there is no fixed place for those things on the spectrum. It's all about how you do it. There are no rules. The only people who think they're rules are the people who feel they're the victims of cancel culture. I think for the rest of us, we know that when we read one of the novels which sits in the middle of that spectrum, it feels right or it doesn't feel right. And I have read many books and I just felt this has the wrong feel to it. There's not enough empathy here. There's not enough. You don't have the ability to put yourself in these people's shoes. And it's very, very hard to articulate why that is sometimes. But I think most writers would agree that, yes, you read it and does it work for you or does it not?
Well, you mentioned empathy several times, and this has come up often where people have commended your writing about the wonderful empathy you show your characters. In Porpoise, for example, when you have a character like Philippe, who is in some ways this monstrous rich tycoon who is, it's not even a case of, as you say, it's not really a case of incest. He is raping his young daughter whom he has captive. But at the same time, he obviously feels that, you know, feels it's great. She's the most precious thing ever for him. And he probably really thinks that he is protecting her from the world out there. Is it hard for you then to get into the, you know, feel empathy for that character?
There are several answers. One literal answer is that I do quite a lot of voluntary work, and I talk to people on both sides of that relationship. So I have, you know, I know a little bit about the situation. Also, as a writer, it's not just that I want to feel empathy for certain people, but certain people in certain difficult situations become particularly interesting. And that situation of how does an abuser justify themselves seems particularly pertinent now. I mean, it occurs to me almost every week, we discover it's almost always a man in some position of power has abused that power sexually, most often with women, sometimes with men. It's really easy to dismiss them and say those people are monsters about whom we should not think. But I think part of preventing that happening again, making that less frequent in our society, we have to understand why it happens. How do these people do these things and justify it to themselves? And every time I hear someone dismissed as evil, I wonder to myself, what's their story? At root, the monsters are not greatly different from the rest of us. How did they end up in that position where they commit monstrous acts? What do we still have in common? And as a writer, that fascinates me.
And in Porpoise, that story is in a way a contemporary retelling of the story of Pericles, whose story begins with where he's confronted with this riddle about a king and a princess, where he figures out the answer is incest, and for that he's chased around the world. A lot of us read these stories from Greek myths as children. We read them as adventure stories. When you read it as an adult, and you know, did it speak to you differently?
I didn't read them as a child, to be honest. I grew up in a house that was, it had books in it, but it wasn't very bookish, certainly wasn't very literary. I think I was the first person to go to university. And as a child, what obsessed me was science. Science was the way I found a route to a bigger world beyond the one that I was experiencing. So in a way, I only came to those stories belatedly. I didn't come to them a second time. I came to them a first time.
So did you come to it through Shakespeare?
I came to it because I went to school and I was taught Latin and Greek under duress, hated them, forgot them. And I taught them to myself again later on. In fact, the exam one would sit at 18, the A-level. I retaught myself classical Greek at the age of 30, I think, and sat the exam in a gymnasium full of schoolgirls, always all of whom were 18, and got my A-level. And learning it for myself was an interesting education experience. It's so much easier when you want to learn something. You know, it takes about a tenth of the effort. We put so much effort in school into not learning, but it gave me access to texts, which I'd only read in translation. And that was thrilling. I mean, I couldn't read them fluently, but I could now read them well enough to get a sort of a smell of the original. And particularly when it comes to, you know, we're talking about the violence, the misogyny, the nastiness in some of these texts. One, yes, it's interesting to read the versions that are not Bowdlerized, but also the terrible things in those texts often have a patina of antiquity over them, don't they? I mean, the most famous example is Ovid's Metamorphoses. It is a catalogue of rapes. I mean, just to be blunt about it, it's all rapes. But we don't see that, or at least we have to be reminded of that. We have to be reminded to pull the patina back. I mean, for me, the most obvious answer to help people understand that is to send them round to an art gallery and to remind them they're looking at naked women on every wall, but they don't look like naked women. As long as it's an oil painting with a heavy ornate gold frame around it, it looks like something else, which is not quite a naked woman. And I think the job of a lot of writing is to sort of shoehorn us out of those presumptions so that we can see the world with a few layers peeled off for what it is.
Well, tell us about, you know, one of the reasons where you chose this, one of the plays of Shakespeare, which is less known to many people, Pericles, and because some of the things you are just talking about is what you wanted to illustrate in there, where there's a line, in fact, in the novel where you say, to discover that the sex too weak to have dominion in the physical world are possessed of demonic powers in the other world is hard to bear.
So, a potted version. I had been toying with the idea of adapting a Shakespeare play into prose for some time. Quite a few other authors had done something similar. Howard Jacobson, Jeanette Winterson, they'd all done work in that series. I didn't quite have the chutzpah to take on one of the major plays, so I put it to the back of my mind. Then two things happened. I reread Pericles, which is a late play of which Shakespeare only wrote half. The other half was written by a playwright, brothel keeper, and abuser of women called George Wilkins. And it's not a terribly good play. It also contains a device at the beginning, which seemed to me sort of profoundly immoral. This young woman is being abused by her father, a king. He needs to marry her off. he can't marry her off because her husband will find out what's been happening. But if he doesn't marry her off, people will wonder why. So he sets the suit as a riddle. If they fail the riddle, they get their heads chopped off. Pericles solves the riddle, but the riddle is a revelation of what the relationship is between father and daughter. He is then disgusted by this woman he was planning to marry and runs away. And the play in Shakespeare's hands is basically his running away round the Mediterranean, having adventures. This poor woman, this princess, is given no name, two lines, and she appears in one scene. And then we hear later in the play via a messenger that she and her father have been killed by lightning in a chariot by God in vengeance for their equally shared moral transgressions. I thought I would like to rewrite this play in prose, not as a sort of slavish version, but as an argument with Shakespeare over his abuse of this already abused woman. Although in Shakespeare's defense, I should say that most critics agree that he wrote the second half of the play, and the first half of the play was written by George Wilkins, a truly terrible man in many ways.
But is there a danger in a writer writing to write that sounds like a terrible tongue twister, I'm sorry. Is there a danger in a writer writing to write a wrong?
Yes, there is a danger in any writer having, as it were, a campaigning purpose in a book. As readers, we can really tell when an author is trying to change our mind about something. I would avoid that like the plague. But I'm also reassured that if you have a worldview, and I think my worldview is, I think empathy is probably the principle that underlies it. It's hard to read my books without, as it were, getting that message, if we want to call it a message. On the other hand, I find it hard to write without some imperative, often a moral imperative. I feel that a story needs to be written on some level. I sometimes don't understand that need until I'm writing it. But with The Porpoise, I had that need up front. I thought, here is a character who has been used in a play, but has a story of their own to tell, but wasn't allowed to tell it. My job is to tell that story. So yes, I was writing a wrong, but it was a wrong on paper. And it gave me, as it were, the fuel to complete that book.
There's Fred Wilson, the artist, has written about, you know, he used to do this project where he'd have these paintings where you would see white people in the foreground and there would be slaves in the background. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever talked about slave. And he concocted this whole story where he would have these docent-led tour through the houses where the docents would make up these stories about the African-Americans in the background for the people. And at the end of it, people would realize that the stories were completely made up. And it was astonishing to see how many people were actually really angry about the fact that these, you know, they felt like in a way they had been cheated in telling these stories. So it goes back to what you were saying about you see the naked women, but you don't think of them as naked women, you know, because you're trained to see these works of art in certain ways.
Yep. That's true. And that's one of the ways in which people's history is taken from them, isn't it? Not just, as it were, that the victors write the history, but that becomes the definition of history. What is set down very objectively in books and inscribed on stone, so that they can turn around and say to other people, if all you have is an oral history, if all you have is stories that we have to reconstruct, that's not real history, is it? It becomes a sort of a double erasure of those people's history.
Now, speaking of empathy though, Mark, when you wrote Curious Incident, so Christopher, who is autistic, he cannot empathize with others. He takes everything very literally. How was it for you to try to put yourself in the shoes of someone who cannot put himself into other people's shoes?
Oh, there are many ways of answering that question. One is that it is surprisingly easy to put yourself in the shoes of someone who has no empathy, because empathy can be hard work sometimes. And to put yourself in those shoes gives you a little holiday, a holiday from thinking too hard about other people. And in a way, it's quite a relief to be in those shoes. A second answer would be to say that Christopher is not that different from many of us. I mean, all the maths and science comes from me as a teenager. In fact, every single one of his quirks, traits, behaviors, beliefs, I borrow from someone I know, none of whom would think of themselves as having any kind of disability. So I know lots of people who need certain sort of numbers to fall right on a certain day to feel confident about doing certain thing. People who can't have different types of food touching, people who are obsessed with different colors. And I think everyone who reads the book will say of Christopher, oh yes, that's me, or that's me. You know, descriptions of the book suggest he's an alien. He's not. He's not. He has something in common with absolutely everyone. What did make it reasonably straightforward with Christopher is that I could sit down and say, what are the principles by which he runs his life? And I could, you know, there's sort of five or six principles that anyone can see if they read the book, as it were. But only as I was doing that did it sort of occur to me that we all run our lives in that fashion. We have some very, very strict rules. I mean, the one I use, for example, is about personal space. Depending on who you are and where you are and what you're doing, if you get someone's personal space slightly wrong, it becomes extremely uncomfortable. When I think of the tube in London, you're allowed to press against another human being as long as it's back to back. You're not allowed to do that facing someone. You can do it to the side. And we, in every position, there's a little bubble we carry around us, and we know instantly if someone's crossed that line. And I think there are rules like that which cover every single aspect of our life. But because we don't see them as rules, we just think that's the way life is. They're still rules, and they're still as rigid as Christopher's rules.
Yeah, and in some ways, you're right. You know, when I reread the book, I felt like Christopher is really more than the, you know, the autism and stuff. He's more like a math nerd who is, rather than a detective whose job it is to put themselves in someone else's shoes all the time, he is more like this math nerd who can't rest easy if things are not adding up correctly in the way he feels they should be.
A good friend of mine who is a professor of computing and a very, very good mathematician, he read the novel, and I said to him, because a lot of people had asked me this question, is it a happy or a sad ending? And he said, oh, I think it's quite happy. He'll go on to get a reasonable job at a red brick university in a department like mine, and he won't be that different from many of his colleagues. The other point thing I often say about the maths to people is he's often described as a maths genius. And I have to say, he only looks like that to people who don't know maths. A mathematician reading the book will just say, oh, he's quite good at maths. But mathematics is one of those languages which looks absolutely impenetrable to someone who doesn't understand it. In fact, I was pretty much as good as Christopher at maths. And I took my maths A-level and then further maths A-level very, very early. But in truth, I'm not that good at maths. I was planning to do maths at university until I luckily changed to English. And the truth is, I was nowhere near good enough to do maths at university. So you're absolutely right. Christopher's a maths nerd with many of the things that implies, but he's not a maths genius.
As an author, obviously, you know, you want the kind of success that a book like Curious Incident brings. But did that also ever get to you? You know, recently I was reading about after Christopher Plummer died, and I was reading one of his obituaries. He complained that The Sound of Music was like this albatross he kept that kept following him around everywhere. Did you ever feel like that?
No. In fact, when it initially started, it was a very, very odd experience. I found it a little scary. The image I've often used is that as a child, you, well, certainly I, and I'm sure this is quite common, I had a dream of flying. And for example, it was a flying car. I think, wouldn't it be wonderful if your car flew, you know, like in Harry Potter? But if you're driving along the motorway and your car takes off, you don't think, this is great, my car is flying. You think to yourself, oh dear God, what's happening? I'm going to die. How do I control this thing? And when Curious Incident, as it were, took off, yes, it's what all authors dream of, but it was a case of, oh my God, how do I control this thing? I spent a long time on the treadmill talking about Curious, traveling to places, doing many interviews. And then I realized I had to get off, but I just had to stop doing it. It was a gold-plated ball and chain. And I knew I had to put it to one side. I think we all know novelists who have had a huge success with one work, both for adults or for children. They have made it their profession to be the person who wrote that and engage in all the sort of subsidiary jobs it makes available. I refused all of those jobs.
You don't want to be the you don't want to go to Las Vegas and do the beat.
No, or I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to write the stage play. I left that up to someone else completely and then just turned up on first night. And in fact, about 7 years ago, I took a vow that I would never do an event which was centered on Curious Incident. And that was difficult saying to people because lots of people asked me and I would say, it took over my life and I need light and space inside my head to think of other things. And once I took that vow, I felt that light and space enter my head again.
Did you feel that light and space when you published a book of poems after Curious Incident?
To some extent, but I was still on the treadmill. I hadn't quite managed to get myself off the treadmill by then.
But you also thought it was unadaptable. So were you surprised at how it turned out on stage?
I was surprised that Simon Stevens, who did the adaptation, thought he could do it. But once he'd begun it and talked a bit about it, I realized that he could do it. It was also a huge education for me in terms of the difference between writing for the stage and writing a novel, which I'd never really understood before. Several things Simon would always say. Simon would always say, remember the spelling of playwright. It's not W-R-I-T-E, it's W-R-I-G-H-T. It's like wheelwright or shipwright. You know, the shipwright doesn't make it all. The shipwright builds a hull that floats and puts some superstructure on top. Then they give it to someone else to add everything else. He said, that's my job as a playwright. I just make the words work and then I hand it over to someone else. Me, I couldn't do that. You know, I like the benign fascism of the page. I like to be in charge of absolutely everything. I also realized that, and Simon always looks at drama this way, and it's true of stage and it's true of film. You must feel that the whole work and indeed each scene is like a sporting match. It's like football, boxing, whatever. It has to involve at least two people who have conflicting desires and aims and ambitions. And that scene is each trying to get their own way, however subtle, even if it's Chekhov or Beckett, that is happening under the surface. And if it doesn't happen, the tension falls flat immediately. If you're a good writer of prose, however, you can describe the weather for five pages. I mean, you have to be very good to do that, but you don't need the same kind of friction.
Well, you are, I mean, anybody reading even Porpoise, the beginning, like the first thing, you feel the tension immensely because you even announce this character is going to die. And still you, as a reader, you're on tenterhooks waiting for this character to die. And while reading, I was thinking, you know, maybe obviously these things are not so connected, but you're a vegetarian. And I have to say, you are not squeamish at all about blood and gore. I mean, there's a dog dying on the first page of Curious Incidents. This actress dies. Death opens Porpoise in your short stories. In the first story, 60-something people die. Somebody's fingers gets chopped off. A shotgun blows up someone's chest. Where does your fascination for blood and gore come from?
I think part of me is still a 12-year-old boy. So, you know, I still enjoy it on a sort of simple, visceral level. But more seriously, I think I had a revelation a number of years ago that one of these false distinctions we have between literary and genre novels is that there is a certain kind of nice middle-class person who will read a crime novel and expect a high level of blood, gore, violence, and abuse. And that is entirely acceptable. Then when we step back across the borders to literature, there's a kind of niceness about it. We turn away from those things. I mean, a really good example would be a short story which caused a stir some years ago by Hilary Mantel called The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher, which deals with everything up to the moment when this IRA terrorist fires a shot out of a window of a nearby flat. And I thought to myself, that is exactly how literature works, isn't it? You stop just before the interesting bit. If I was going to write that story, I'd say, why waste it? We have Margaret Thatcher being shot. That is a glorious scene, is it not? Why turn away? So in terms of sort of a structural tactic, you know, go for the drama. Why not? It engages readers, it entertains readers. On a moral level, and this goes back again to, I talked earlier about doing voluntary work with people in some very, very difficult situations. We all know people, and maybe we've been in that state in our own lives, when we have to face some fairly monstrous and difficult things, death, disease, abuse, our instinct is to turn away. But I've learned over the years, talking to people who've been in those situations, turning away never helps. But actually looking at the monster itself always reduces it somewhat. However terrible that situation is. I mean, I've had friends who are dying. And accepting that fact, looking at death, talking about death, always, always reduces the fear of dying, and I think. So, yes, on the one hand, it's a sort of just a technique to hold the reader's attention and entertain, but I think there's a real moral purpose there as well. Let's not turn away from the difficult things, the hard experiences of being human.
Well, since you're speaking of death and we're almost out of time, I'm going to try my technical prowess and play a little clip for you. And I want you to hear it, and then I'll tell you why I'm playing it.
মেঘ বরণ তুজ মেঘ যথাযুত রক্ত কমল ধর রক্ত অধর পুত তাপ বিমোচন করুণা কোর তব মৃত্যু অমৃত করে দান তুহু মম শ্যাম সমান।
I don't know if you recognize this. This is actually my mother, and she's reciting a poem. And she's reciting it from memory because I told her in your story about the astronauts dying in Mars.
Yeah.
When they are dying, one of the characters reads these lines from a Tagore poem.
Yes.
And, you know, which is about, written by Tagore when he's 16 years old, about embracing death like a lover. You know, about like how you can accept death. And my mother had danced to this over 60 years ago. And as soon as I said, do you remember that? She said, of course I do, and rattled off the lines. And I was wondering, where did those lines come? How did you encounter those lines from Tagore?
Indirectly, I have a friend who is a great fan of Tagore's work. And I think we've been talking about it, and that must have come up in conversation. So I looked it up. And this is going to seem very shallow now, but it's true of many things that go into The Porpoise and other books. Everyone has a very small store of things which are hugely important to them. And you could spend all of those in one novel, couldn't you? What I do now is I find myself traveling the world of ideas, of stories, of experiences. And whenever something has a deep rightness to it, I just sort of tuck it into my back pocket, as it were. And I know I can use it at some point. And I tucked that lyric into my back pocket. And I thought, it has enormous magnetism, enormous power. I will just plunder it purely for my own purposes. I wish there was some grander scheme at work, but novelists are tricksters, aren't they? We're trying to give you the impression that there's this superb construction, but it's all smoke and mirrors. But as long as the smoke and mirrors move you, then I think we've won.
I can't think of a better note to end this conversation on, Mark. So thank you so much for spending this time with us.
And thank you very much indeed. That was really enjoyable.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Jaipur Bites, the JLF podcast. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Launchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please subscribe or follow to this show wherever you're listening to this.